I don't think it was cold.
It's because you're from Ireland.
I'm going to have to disagree with you there.
we put some photos and videos of you on the start line, and I got a couple comments back that you could tell that you were from a not southern Spain. We'll put it that way. You in your short sleeves next to a bunch of Belgians, let's say, in jackets. So I'm not sure that you're the best person to actually judge.
I was
these
there
things.
To race.
Yeah.
You want to be in the breakaway, you don't wear a rain jacket.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Placeholders Podcast. We are... Well, Johnny, why don't you set the scene for me?
We are in an attic room surrounded by bikes that you and Ronan were picking your jaws up off the floor when you saw them. I felt a bit left out because tech doesn't move me in the same way it does to you guys, so I feel a bit sort of emotionally inept, but I was enjoying your guys' enjoyment of all the bicycles. And there's about 20 just here. There's more downstairs.
It's amazing. The room.
I can't believe you threw to Johnny to set the scene there.
Yeah, I was a bit flummoxed.
Ronan, can you please reset the scene for me? Where are we more generally?
We're in the Flandrian Hotel, which is about halfway between Brakel and Gerritsbergen in Belgium, along the what I would consider the traditional Tour of Flanders route, which used to go Brakel, Gerritsbergen, Mur, Bosberg, and finish in Ninove. We're right along that course, and it's a cycling specific sort of hotel and I guess museum, really, isn't it, when you look at the bikes on show here.
We're surrounded by young men racing bicycles, which is always fun.
Yeah, it doubles up as a hotel for cycling fans and tourists, and kids who want to come here, and but I say kids, but they're like under 23s, and that they want to come here to Belgium, race their bikes, race kermesses, some of which we've seen today. I'm sure we'll get into that later. but like for Kaylee and I, Johnny, the reason our jaws were hitting the floor with every other room that we walked into was because in this room alone, I can see Matt Heyman's Colnago C50, I can see a Quick Step Time VXRS, I can see Hincapie's Trek. Not the one that actually snapped at Roubaix, but...
The backup. That would have snapped, for
yes.
sure.
I can see Balan's Willier from, 2010 era, roughly? There's a Fassa... Oh, sorry. Yes, a Fassa Bartolo bike, which is supposedly Frank Vandenbroek's reserve bike. Chris Horner's Ridley from Lotto Days is here. There's a CSC Soloist here.
I think
the bike
it's Stuart
that
O'Grady's.
Basically... Stuart O'Grady's CSC Soloist. That is the bike that effectively... made my job possible as a tech writer. And lastly, I saved the best for last year. I could go on and on, but the last one I want to mention is the MAPEI Colnago C40, which is a bike I will be riding tomorrow.
Yeah, which that's the amazing thing, is these are, I think, almost all rideable. And Jamie, our host here, has said that we can actually maybe head out in them tomorrow. So, Ronan, you're going to be riding a C40. There's absolutely no question about that. And I haven't quite decided what I think.
We all want to ride Frank Vandenbroek's Dogma, but
it will fall apart.
The magnesium used in that era has a tendency to break, and so I think that's the one frame that's not allowed to leave here.
I wouldn't want that on my shoulders. No.
I wouldn't want it underneath me either.
No, not particularly.
Only that era, like, they don't use magnesium anymore, we should say.
Well, yeah, we're in an amazing place, long and short of it, and we've been doing some fun things this week. So we're going to talk a little bit about what we've been up to this week, which included a Roubaix recon with the Trek Segafredo team yesterday, and also included betting 10 euros on Ronan.
I feel better now. I thought it was 5 euros.
Five each way.
Oh, 5 each way.
Yeah, yeah. So we bet 10 euros on Ronan in a kermesse earlier today, the first one that you've entered for
at least 10 years,
at least a decade. And we didn't really prepare all that much for. You know, your prep was Roubaix Recon yesterday, and then we showed up like a half hour ahead of time, and you made the sign-up cutoff by about 90 seconds, and some angry Belgians weren't super pleased with that, but well, we got you in the race.
In my defense, the last time I went to Kermes, you didn't have to register online at least 24 hours in advance. So when I hadn't done that, it sort of flummoxed him a little bit, but we got there with my sort of Flemglish. We got it through them that I hadn't registered online and I didn't know that I had to and that I should be allowed to race because it wouldn't last long anyway. Which proved accurate.
Well, but not your fault. I should say that we're also going to get into Paris-Roubaix is this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, and we're going to be previewing Paris-Roubaix. Probably at the second half of this episode, because the first half, yeah, is going to be dedicated to, I don't know, all things Belgium, basically. Mm-hmm. The things that we have been doing, and I guess Northern France, which is what we were up to yesterday. Before we get into any of that, though, we got a couple news hits for you. So we actually should have noticed this yesterday, but basically just weren't looking closely enough. We were at the finish of Roubaix at the Velodrome with the Trek ladies and enrolled the human-powered health team. Now, what we didn't clock at the time, because we were a little bit far away and they're all wearing helmets and glasses and things, is that apparently Audrey Cordon-Rigaud was with that crew, right, Johnny?
Yeah, and our colleague Scythe from VeloNews spotted it instead and was on the story. Audrey Cordon-Rigaud was caught up in the whole B&B Hotels team collapse and then was brought into the ZAF team, which also had... Was that from the remnants of the B&B team?
No, separate team, but it was just sort of like the only thing available to a couple of those riders, yeah.
Maybe I thought that just because they were both sort of like burning wreckages of teams by that point.
Yeah, I mean, ZAF was the burning wreckage of itself, unfortunately, okay. And remains so.
Independent fire.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's found... There was some talk before when she couldn't find a team that she'd have to wait until August to sign for a new one. The deadline sort of passed, but somehow that's been sorted out. And she... She ran Paris-Roubaix on Saturday, so quick turnaround from no team to Roubaix.
Yeah, I think you're actually going to get this technically before the embargo lifts. We should say that we didn't get any of this information directly from the team. She's actually on the UCI team roster.
Yeah,
now, so already confirmed whether the team wants us to confirm it or not. And yeah, we if we'd had sharper eyes like Sive did, we would have noticed her yesterday rolling into the Velodrome with that team, I think.
I was focusing on, there were two guys doing like boxing training inside the Velodrome, which kind of caught my eye because I was like, what's going on here? And then you also let me run his bike to quickly do two laps of the Velodrome and refrain from out-sprinting some nine-year-old children. So my mind was elsewhere and not journalistically centered.
not to preempt or Kermes talk in a second, but if you knew then what you know now about my bike, would you have ridden it?
Yeah, because I ride it at a very safe speed where technical fault is almost impossible.
But let's talk Roubaix first, actually. I was going to go talk Kermes first, but since we're already on the Velodrome discussion and talking about what the reason we were in there... So we went and did recon with the Trek Segafredo ladies team yesterday. Ronan, you actually jumped in with them. What were your takeaways from recon day? The first thing you said to me when you got back in the car is there doesn't appear to be a whole lot of point in doing that.
Yeah, that was kind of my main takeaway. Like I've always heard about Roubaix recon day and assumed that, you know, they were checking out lines through corners and riding sectors over and over again and looking for the best line possible. And, you know, part of my head was always saying, well, what is even the point in that? Because you get into the race and your position is, while you might be able to dictate that you want to be at the front of a peloton, your position on the road is ultimately dictated by the other 200 riders around you in some manner. And so you can't just pick your line through the sectors anyway. And yeah, part of that proved to be true because when I joined the Trek riders yesterday, there was no redoing sectors over and over again looking for the best tire pressure. There was only like one stop where they actually looked at tire pressures, and it was more just like we have to do a training ride, so we might as well do it on the course that we're riding on Saturday anyway, just on the off chance that perhaps we'll see a huge hole that now exists that didn't last year, or as you put it, Kayleigh, you never know what little bit of information may prove to be a wheel saver or whatever on come Saturday. And if you just happen to know that there is a ridge on this side that isn't on the other side and you have an option to avoid it, just that little bit of information could save your whole race. So, you know, I was chatting to the riders and asking them, you know, what are you hoping to get out of today? And most of the sort of vibe I was getting was familiarization and just, you know, get a feel for the cobbles again, check them out. The cobbles were in pretty good condition yesterday. It was mostly dry. A couple of muddy sections that had, you know, dried into sort of mounds in the center of the road, exactly on the line where you would want to ride. But since yesterday, it's done pretty much nothing but rain. So even that, you know, the riders are very aware that what they were seeing, the state that they were seeing the cobbles in yesterday wasn't even going to be the way they would see them on Saturday. So again, it was very much just, we have to do a training ride anyway. And I asked Eleanor Baxter, you know, are you doing any intervals or efforts or anything here? And her response was kind of, well, the cobbles are effort enough. So even that didn't have much, you know, I'm not trying to undersell what they were doing. It was very much a relaxed sort of atmosphere yesterday, whereas I have always thought that the Roubaix Recon would be very, not tense, but very focused, maybe.
Yeah, I guess the no point is a bit harsh. More like there's no specific objective that needs to be accomplished other than we need to go ride our bikes for a couple hours, so we might as well go do it on the same terrible, terrible roads that we're going to have to ride on Saturday.
Yeah, well, actually, I'd asked Lucinda Brown when we were just about to roll into the Roubaix Velodrome, did you learn anything today, or, you know, did you pick up anything useful from riding the course today? And she sort of hesitated for a second, then she went, they're still shit, and laughed, which kind of confirmed everything that we knew, that yes, they are still crap. They have not tarmacked over the cobbled sectors, so nope. It's still going to be the hell of the north. And actually, the main takeaway point is the recon rides that I wanted to see, all the testing and the tire pressure and the wheel selection and, you know, which gearing should we opt for. Gearing is a huge one. Like when the Women's Roubaix started 2 years ago and Lizzie Dagnan won, the whole track team were on 50-tooth 1x chainrings. Fast forward to this year, they're all on 52-tooth 1x chainrings. Still 1x, still SRAM, but now they've moved up to 52. And, you know, is the race getting faster? I don't know, but that's one thing that they had tested since, tried out, and have made that increase in the chainring count. But basically, what they've, all those testing days and recon days do happen. It's just that they happened last September and last February and a month ago. Mm-hmm. They don't today, or yesterday even, was just a final ride out on the exact setup that they're going to use on Saturday. And there's, you know, they've pretty much got their setup dialed by the time they get to Roubaix this week.
Yeah, like you said, there were a couple small tire pressure adjustments. Koen de Kort was out there kind of chatting with the team, and he's sort of the one of the team technical liaisons now, and they made some adjustments, and I think it was Elisa Longoburghini who dropped some pressure at one point in time down to 3.3 bar is what she was asking for. What's that in PSI? 47 PSI is 3.3 bar. So that's, I think that she was 3.3, 3.5. She did attempt to trick me by switching into Italian to ask for whatever that was, 23, 25. There's my Italian for you. But unfortunately for her, I do at least count to 5.
Why was she trying to trick you?
I don't know, because they're very weird about their tire pressures at Roubaix. Like you wander around at the start, and they, you know, all the mechanics have the little, like, they have essentially a, it's like a drill, right, that has been converted into an air compressor, and they've got a you know, there's a PSI or bar meter on the back, and pressure meter on the back, and like they'll hide it from you. They literally hide it from you, and I'm not really sure why.
It's mostly because it's like it was once considered like almost a lost art or a dying art, the understanding of which tire pressure to have for each day. And tire pressure was, you know, in a time, you know, in the land before dinosaurs or whatever, when the only thing we had was round tubes and 32 spoke wheels and tubulars that had cured in your basement for 10 years, tire pressure was, and still is to this day, I'm not, you know, it is still critical, but back then it was even like it was probably the biggest change that you could make on Roubaix day to influence how much grip you had over the cobbles and how cushioned your ride was. And as such, you know, you too low is a disaster, too high is even worse, and that sweet spot is very, very hard to find. So, you know, the tire pressure that the big Roubaix champions would have used would have been a closely guarded secret, because it was like the one aspect that they could really dial in on race day, and but also could be easily shared if it got out.
The cycling's equivalent of the Colonel's 11 herbs and spices. Yes. Is that what we're talking here?
Yes.
Putting it into terms that I can understand. Okay, got it.
Yeah, that's accurate.
Cool. Yep. We've got a worrying tradition of including KFC in our podcasts.
Is this a good time to announce them as our first sponsor?
I want to go back to that though. 3.3, it seems to me pretty high for, like, at least a Longo Borghino must be sub 60 kilos, I'm guessing.
I mean, I've never picked her up, but I I would imagine so.
You've got scales in your hands.
It's a relief to hear that Kaylee's never picked up Elisa Longo Borghini.
No, but I don't want to quote a figure now off the top of my head because I'm not confident in remembering it accurately, but I'm pretty sure Lizzie Deignan's tire pressures were in the 30s when she won 2 years ago. 30-something rings a bell.
Well, is it possible that Elisa was giving me numbers in PSI and not bar?
Yeah,
could be 33 and 35.
Very PSI. Possible. That would make a lot more sense in my head, which admittedly doesn't really count for much. But
See, this is the problem with you tech guys. You're always chasing a dream that can never be quenched. You're always after more and more information, and you never get there. But maybe that's not the point. Maybe it's the journey that you guys savor.
Speaking of tire pressure, one of the other little news items we had for this week, which has been bounced around for the last 2 years, was that Jumbo-Visma is potentially using, now I'm forgetting the brand name that makes this thing, but
it's Grava Cap.
Grava.
Grava's a brand, Caps is a hub system.
Gotcha. And they're in theory, potentially, using this for Paris-Roubaix, basically so they can increase tire pressure and decrease tire pressure while they're riding. Do you think they will actually run this thing, Ronan?
I do not think the big name riders and the favorites on these teams will ride them. And that's not to say that I don't think they should. It's just I don't think they will. I've covered both systems. There are tire pressure management systems built into the hub. They can inflate and deflate your tire pressure on the go through a click of the button on your handlebars, up and down for both front and rear wheels. And I have covered both the Grava Caps and the Scope Atmos in a lot of detail previously. The one race per year where these make a lot of sense is Paris-Roubaix, at least on the roadside. And basically what's sort of come up this week is both brands have suggested, much like Scope did last year, that the system would be used in Paris-Roubaix. The systems haven't changed much in the past year, or haven't changed at all in the past year. And this is kind of like it's like Christmas Day for tire pressure management systems. Christmas week even. Christmas Day is on Sunday, and this is the one week of the year where they can really push these things on the roadside. And as such, we've heard much talk about them again this week, that they might be used, they might not be used. I think they will not be used because my understanding is the deflation is obviously very, very useful. You could set your tire pressure, bearing in mind the first, 160 kilometers of this race is on pretty good tarmac surfaces. Will be extremely fast if it's anything like last year. I think at the moment it's sort of it's side tailwind forecast, so it should be fast again, dry conditions on Sunday as well. And as such, you do actually want a bike that's pretty optimal for road racing in the first 160 kilometers. But then, you know, there's obviously this flip of the switch, and when you hit the final 100 kilometers of Paris-Roubaix, especially from Arenberg onwards, or even before that with Twelveville and other sectors,
it's pretty bad. We always say it starts in Arenberg, but having sat behind the race in like a Mavic neutral car, there are plenty of riders whose day is over well, well before we get to the Arenberg Forest every single year.
And so the optimal tire pressure for that opening tarmac section and the cobbled sectors after that is very, very different. And if you even had a system that would allow you to deflate for the first cobbled sector and stay there from then on, that would be a significant advantage. The promise of these systems is that you can inflate and deflate on the go between sectors. Mm-hmm. The Scope Atmos does it the quicker of the two systems, or can inflate a tire quicker of the two systems, but can only do 8 inflation and deflation cycles. It's sort of compressed system. It's a closely guarded secret exactly how it works, but basically you've got 8 cycles built into the hub and rim there. So yes, that would be useful. Then the Gravic Caps, it's sort of only, well, it's not really limited. It can do many more cycles, but it can only inflate at 1 PSI per kilometer. And as such, if you need to drop 10 PSI, 15, 20 PSI for a cobbled sector, you haven't got 20 kilometers between sectors to get back up again to the optimal road pressure. And, you know, basically by the time you get back to the optimal road pressure, you would be back on another sector and looking to drop it again. So for that reason, that's the system Jumbo-Visma are treading at the moment. For that reason, so long as that hasn't changed from the first time I've tried the system, I that's one of the reasons they may not use it on Sunday. The other reason is just the added opportunity for something to go wrong.
Yeah.
And just imagine a complete deflation if the system fails or something. Like, I don't even know if that's possible, but I know that's a pro rider's mindset.
Yep.
And Wout van Aert can win Roubaix without tire pressure management systems. And as open as he is to new technology, I don't think he'll be open yet to trying this.
Yeah. Even if the risk isn't big, if there's any risk and no guaranteed reward, then that's, I think it's pretty easy to see which way they'll go.
I do know other teams have tried it as well, and flat out are not using it. And what I've been told is it's not that they don't rate the system. They're not ready to trial it in one of the biggest races of the year yet.
And this is probably the only race of the year where it makes any sense on the road.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, for
like
sure.
Like gravel racing, you could see it working pretty well for something like Belgian Waffle Ride or something like that, for example. But in the road space, this is probably the only place where it makes any sense at all. So before we get to our kind of official big Roubaix preview where we talk about who might win and the weather and all the rest of the things that might impact this weekend's racing, we had some racing today. Running
biggest race of the week.
Biggest race of the week by far. Could you give us a quick race report on how it went down?
Basically, we were sitting here in the Flandrian Hotel, and I turned to the both of you and said, "If we want to do a kermesse this afternoon, we have to leave within the next 7 minutes." We managed to leave within the next 7 minutes. We got to a race in Bellingham, or Bellingham, if you want to say it in Flemish, and signed on. I was the last rider to sign on. The first rider who hadn't pre-registered. I think I got number 177, so it was a
175.
175. So
yeah, we know because we were betting on you.
Yeah, 175 riders in the race, and rolled out from the main street on Bellingham at 3 p.m. there. Well, it wasn't pouring rain, was it? But the roads were very, very wet.
Yeah, it was damp and quite cold. Mm. Yeah,
I don't think it was cold.
Ireland.
I'm going to have to disagree with you there.
we put some photos and videos of you on the start line, and I got a couple comments back that you could tell that you were from a not southern Spain. We'll put it that way. You in your short sleeves next to a bunch of Belgians, let's say, in jackets. So I'm not sure that you're the best person to actually judge.
I was there
things.
To race.
Yeah.
You want to be in the breakaway, you don't wear a rain jacket. My chances of getting in the breakaway were foiled, however.
It went pretty well for the first 4 or 5 laps.
I mean, like at the start, when it was pretty easy, yeah, I was able to sit near the front. I was mostly, I have to say, I really, really enjoyed it, being back in the kermesse. I should say that I was not forced to do this whatsoever. This was entirely my own idea, my own decision to sign on for this race and start the race. And even on the start line, I wasn't all that up for it, but literally within 10 seconds, I think. And I have to say, that was experience kicking in that the race started at 3 o'clock, and while Lawler started queuing up for the start at 2:45, and we're at the very, very back of the 175 rider bunch by the time it was starting, I rocked up at 1 second to 3 o'clock, and they had no option but to let me join on the very front row. And so I was at the front, and you know, half the battle in these kermesse races, and any race in Belgium actually, is just positioning. And you know, I was saying to Johnny earlier, the biggest thing about kermesse is almost is number one, positioning, and number two is the gear that you need to sprint out of the corner, and you need to be in it before you go into the corner. I had a bit of problems with shifting, we'll get to that in a second, which made that very, very difficult. But you know, as such, especially on today's course, and the course today was, I think that was why I enjoyed it most, was because it was a mixture of nice wide roads where you could easily get back position if you wanted, but also we had real kermesse racing down country lanes with left and right. It was, you know, there wasn't even a hedge at the side of the road. It was just completely open. Where the road ended, the field started. And you had an echelon down one of the roads every time we went down that road. And it was real proper kermesse racing. I really enjoyed it for the four laps that I did.
Well, but how did things end? Because it wasn't your fault that we went four laps. It kind of was, but kind of wasn't.
It wasn't even your deflating tyre that was the problem.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I was going to say there is an old saying that if you fail to fix a puncture, prepare to fail, or something to that effect. And so I started the race with a tubeless tire that wasn't properly sealing. I think I had something like Trek Segafredo tire pressures on the start line, roughly around 30 PSI, which in today's conditions was like, I was railing the corners. In hindsight, I wouldn't want it any harder. It was perfect with 32 mil tires, 30 odd PSI. Yeah, that was great. But as a consequence of doing the Roubaix recon yesterday, so this puncture that I should say the reason I had used to fail to prepare saying there was because I've had this puncture for 4 days. This puncture has been plaguing me for 4 days.
This is the problem with tubeless. I keep saying this. If it was a tube, you would have just fixed it. It would have taken 5 minutes and we would have been fine. Mm. But because tubeless gave you a false sense of security, we kept assuming it would seal, and it just didn't.
First ride in Belgium, we got this puncture on Monday.
Yep.
It kind of spoiled Tuesday's ride. Midway through the Roubaix recon, I had to change the wheel again because it was still punctured. When I changed wheels, then I had a problem with my shifting where it was just all over the place, and I assumed it was the chain to cassette where it was mismatched or whatever, and the chain was jumping all over the place. Cue 30 seconds before the kermesse today, it turns out that even with my own wheel back in, it still wasn't shifting
right. Something weird going
on. There was something very weird going on. Yeah. So I was kind of committed at that point. Started the race, had basically zero shifting. The shifting I did have, I had to give 30 seconds for each shift to happen, which made it very difficult to be in the right gear for exiting a corner before I entered the corner while maintaining position. And I spent that four laps thoroughly enjoying the race and also kind of wondering, should I just pull out? Because it didn't really seem like a great idea to be mashing gears every time I sprinted. Eventually, that decision was made for me when the chain snapped. Which, you know, main thing, I kept it upright. Didn't have an issue there, didn't crash. But, that's a PSA for today. If your gears are jumping about, maybe stop and get them checked.
Yeah, I mean, the chain clearly had just seen too much. It was really...
No, it's not a new chain. It's...
No, but I mean, like, it had seen too much that day.
Oh,
like,
okay.
It was over it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a relatively new chain in good nick. It was not the quick link is not what broke.
No.
We thought maybe it was at first, but no, it was near that, and it just snapped in two because it had been hucked between
I don't know
too many times.
If you know, the split second before I changed the wheel yesterday on the recon, or the minute or two after I took off from changing wheel, did something on the cobbles twist a link or whack the derailleur or did something? The derailleur seems a bit unhappy as well.
It's like weirdly wrapped around. Yeah, anyway.
So, yeah, something from yesterday's recon spoiled today's race. And it could not have went any better because I was still enjoying the race, still feeling good, following attacks at the front. And then my race was ended through mechanical. So the only way that could have went,
yeah.
the only way that could have went better would have been had I won the race, and that wasn't going to happen. So I'm delighted with how that ended.
We were hoping it had happened. And if we'd had all of that context when we approached the bookmaker to bet on you, we might have got a better price.
You might not have even bothered approaching them.
Well, you gotta back your buddies. I mean, in what other
five or each way? Like, come on, show a bit of respect here. €50, I might have been a bit of respect.
He can't get a receipt for that. That's his own. That's hard earned. That is not £5 or €5.
Surely the betting slip's a receipt.
True, actually. We'll see if that goes through the accounting
department.
Yeah, the expense software. But we saw when the eventual winner, there were people walking away from the bookies. He was holding like at least five €50 notes. So people would put serious money on this race. What was good after we bet on you was that your name went up on the board because they put the guy, he had a fantastic hat and mustache.
Like a waxed handlebar mustache, which is
fantastic.
Excellent.
He was well turned out, and he had a big whiteboard and separated into columns and rows of all the riders you could bet on. And there was a little gap at the bottom. And when we asked for you, we showed a picture, or can we bet on 175? And then he looked at the sheet, R. McLaughlin, was like, 25-1. And we're like, sure.
Well, he took a close look at the picture because he wanted to know what we were betting on.
Yeah.
Right? And he's like, I need to take a look at this racehorse here before we get him up on the board.
We made sure to show a photo of you just for the start where you had your jacket on unzipped. But then when we went up afterwards and we're like, oh, this is our guy, and you know, he's out. And
not afterwards, when we went up mid-race with me, the guy that you bet on in the race.
But then he like unceremoniously just wiped your name off the whiteboard, yes. Which was
a brutal ending to an otherwise excellent
but
day.
But while the sport, can your someone you've traveled there with just turn up and compete and then you can bet on them? Where does that happen?
Greyhound racing.
We'll try that next week, Ronan.
I might have a better chance.
We brought our own dog, is what we did.
We did, and we've made him do the Roubaix Recon. We've made him do the Kermesse. You want to see what we've got in store for you tomorrow, right?
Cannot wait. Loving it.
Well, it was a great day out, and the Kermesse. I mean, the Kermesse scene is it builds bike racers, right? And not just from Belgium. I mean, you know, Ronan, you did this as a young man, as like somebody trying to make a go of it as a professional athlete. There are other young men in this hotel with us right now who are, you know, trying to make a go of it and make a career out of it, and that's why they're here. And these are the things that they do. There were some of them in the race with you today, right? And it's an amazing scene, and in some ways, it sounds like it hasn't changed a lot in the 10 years you've been away, but in some ways it kind of has. There's fewer of them than there used to be, right? Was there anything else that kind of shifted since your old days?
I mean, like when you take a step back and think about it, this was a random Thursday afternoon in a small village. It was slightly bigger than a village, very, very small town in near sort of Oudenaarde direction in Belgium.
Just south of Kortrijk.
Had 175 riders from as far-flung places as Belgium,
Ireland,
Malaysia. There were Malaysian riders,
Norway,
Ukrainian riders,
Ukraine,
English.
Yes, there was an international field, and you know that is obviously a great thing. Everybody turned up. You pay your €15 to enter it. If you bring your numbers back at the end, you get €5 back. So it costs you a tenner to do this race.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, and that's always been the way it's worked. Like, you look at some of the races now, we have I know especially in Britain, there's a big challenge at the moment organising races on open roads, and you're paying £50, £60, £70 to enter a race on a motor racing circuit. And then you compare that to what they have here in Belgium today, and it just doesn't compare.
Well, that was a nice thing. So it was where the finish line was and where most people were stationed was along the high street, where there were five different bars you could go to, which we were sort of discussing the economics here because it wasn't a big place and there were all these bars. But everyone had people outside, everyone was watching, and then it was like a rolling blockade. Is that what you call it, rolling blockade?
It was a rolling road closure.
That's what it's called. Mm-hmm. So in between, after you guys had gone past, there was like farm vehicles coming like one direction. There was like a mum with her kid on the back of her bike going the other direction. Like normal life just happened, and it was all so seamless that it's like, why can't this happen in most other places? But I think it's just because they keep the cost so low because it's so embedded in the culture, you know?
Yeah.
Yes and no. I think it's embedded in the culture, definitely. And we should also say, like, in addition to all those riders, there was people who had turned out to watch the race. There was also Peter Van Pettigam.
Yeah.
Former Tour of Flanders and Priory Bay winner.
Just hanging out.
Just hanging out.
We think he maybe had a
there
a,
was a V Pettigam on the bookies analog spreadsheet.
Yeah.
The whiteboard may have
been
there
a family member.
Maybe there. It was just betting on him to like turn up and win. You never know.
But anyway, Van Pettigam was here, and it's nowhere near Brackle where Van Pettigam is from, so I don't know where he lives these days, but presumably nearby where he's originally from. Anyway, I was chatting to one of the owners here at the Flandrian Hotel, and I had sort of asked him, you know, whenever I was here 10 years ago, it was already, the kermesse scene was already sort of less of what it was 10 years before that, because when I first came to Belgium, say 2005 or so, you could do a kermesse every day of the week. And there was even times you could do a kermesse at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, finish that, and if you were stone cold crazy, you could go and do another kermesse at 7 p.m. You know, so you could, there was literally two kermesses a day throughout the road season. And when I started sort of having this notion I might do a kermesse when we come back to Belgium this week, I started looking around for options, and there was like two or three this entire week. So it's definitely...
Which is still amazing.
It's still, yeah, still amazing. But the worrying thing there is just in a Belgium, in a country like Belgium, where cycling is just part of the culture, and races are disappearing at that sort of rate. Also, no doubt they took a big drop off after the pandemic a few years ago, like everything did. But also, you know, in chatting to the guy here, he was saying that the cost to run one of these kermesses now is at least $5,000 or so. We had talked about the prize money for this race and thought it was €400 pot with maybe €100 for the winner. It's €400 for the winner. And so the prize pot is, they paid down to 20th place today. So the prize pot's actually probably at least €1,000. You've seen all those barriers along the roadside for the final 300 meters. That costs a lot of money. Mm. When I broke my chain, it was the broom wagon that lifted me, and I was asking him about this kermesse scene, and he was saying, look, I'm here today because I love cycling. I did the Tour of Flanders Sportif on Saturday, but really I should be at work. And most people in my position tend to opt for their day at work rather than taking a day off to go and help the kermesse these days. And that's all playing into it also. Apparently also, from what I understand here, the Wederbond, or the Flemish Cycling Federation, are also sort of upping costs for kermesses. I'm not exactly sure how that might work, but basically, you know, it's a trend we see around the world. It's certainly not reassuring that it's happening in Flanders also. It's perhaps extra worrying that it's happening in Flanders also, because this is the sort of, I think, as I said already, the school of racing. If you can come here in kermesse and win kermesses, you're ready to go pro almost. Like it's great for that. And you know, one of the sort of things I've been thinking this week is that whenever I was here racing from 2005 as a junior through to 2013, I certainly underappreciated how important the kermesses were. And you know, I think I've been mouthing off in the podcast before about Chris Froome talking about training races and stuff, and I didn't like that. And the reason I specifically don't like that is because as a young rider, I fell into the trap of, you know, listening to big pros and big champions like Chris Froome talking about training races, and then, you know, having ideas above my station and thinking I'm riding for a continental team. I'm not that I'm too good for the kermesses, but just it was part of the situation we were in as well, that you had to perform in the pro races the team was doing to get selected for the next pro race. And if a pro race is one of your goals, then that was the vicious circle you were in. But certainly I now sort of look back and go, feck, I wish, you know, take things a bit slower, do a few more kermesses. Really, if I wasn't excelling in kermesses, I wasn't going to be going pro anyway. And then, you know, there's stories every season. There's a young Norwegian kid in the house here at the moment who has started 8 kermesses, has finished on the podium 8 times, and has won 4 of them. So that guy is above kermesses, and he will be pro probably pretty soon. You know, and that's, you know, in hindsight, as much as I did learn from racing in Belgium, I probably could have learned more had I just appreciated just how valuable kermesse racing is.
Coming from a background where I didn't really grow up either racing it or watching the kermesse scene or any of this sort of stuff, it was amazing to see a real sort of community-driven bike racing thing. As you say, if it's getting smaller, that's a really sad thing, and like speaks to everyone having less money and everyone being worked harder and sort of falling economic standards. But, you know, it was great to see that whole, just people out there enjoying a bike race, and it not necessarily out to see a huge star or the celebrity attraction. It was just there to see people racing their bikes.
It was the bike racing. The spectators didn't really care if it was Remco Evenepoel or, you know, a guy who was delivering posts this morning and then races Kermesse in the afternoon, because that's the way a lot of these races are. You know, they're not full-time athletes, they're not professionals, they're Kermesse racers, and they have full-time jobs on the side, and a lot of them do work in the postal service because start early, finish early, yeah, go to the Kermesse. It is very much a community thing. You know, we had the sign on in one bar, we had the funny sign outside another bar, you know, their cafe even, as they're called here, and you had all the different fritura stands and hamburger stands, and normally there would be a Kermesse.
Dried fish,
yes, also. Yes,
looked really gross.
Normally there'd be a Kermesse, like Fun Fair also wasn't in this particular one, but usually the Fun Fair, the Kermesse in a town happens in the same week that the Fun Fair would be there. But not always the case, as we've seen today.
I loved it. I thought it was great. Mm. We were cheering you on. We were sad that you broke a chain.
We're going to go back to the drawing board and plan again for next year.
Yeah.
I think I excelled in my role of holding the bike while you guys were sorting it out. and running up to the start line to catch the coat and the gel wrapper.
So which is a key, very important thing. Yeah, you were a soigneur.
Yeah, I don't think a soigneur would like to hear that. we'll all go back. We'll all figure out our roles and how we want to do things differently next time. I think we should try and
Ronan challenged me to do it next year.
I think we're going to do it next year on one of the bikes here from the museum.
Yeah,
10 speed record. I mean, like, you'll not break a chain then.
I'd be totally into it. I would love it. All right, last thing on the agenda today. We do have to talk about Paris-Roubaix this weekend. We've got two different editions of Paris-Roubaix coming up Saturday and Sunday, and we want to give you a bit of a preview so you know what to expect. I want to start with the weather. Ronan, I know you've had a keen eye on the weather for the last couple days because you were wondering what it was going to do at about 3 o'clock this afternoon. So what are we looking at for Saturday's women's race and Sunday's men's race?
Two very different days, but given the nature of this course, that's, you know, you're unlikely to have different ground conditions, let's say, between the 2 days. So basically it's going to rain a heck of a lot between now and Saturday morning. When I say rain a heck of a lot, it's actually mostly dry, but there's huge downpours forecast for Friday evening, a couple of dry periods, and then throughout Friday night there's a couple of downpours also forecast. And then crucially, around between 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. on Saturday morning, so the day of the women's race, there is almost 10 millimeters of rain forecast for that two and a half hour period. And that will make, you know, it's to be dry from then on, but that will make the conditions absolutely treacherous on the cobbles.
Well, and one of the things we've discovered over the last couple of years, and we've always known this, but there's been rain ahead of the race. I think it was last year, right? Even though the majority of the course was dry, there's a fair amount of just puddles on the side. And then the course is totally dry until the cars go through just ahead of the peloton. And then the cobbles are disgusting. And like, we watched Balsamo fall down right in front of us, in fact, in last year, 2 years ago. 2 years ago,
first edition, yeah.
First year, that's right. I've got them all mixed up in my head now. 2 years ago, we watched that happen, and that was like not a particularly wet, nasty day. Just the fact that all the water had been sort of splashed back into the actual cobbles.
Of course, the winds could also play a role, and depending on the direction, you know, you could have you will have varying wind conditions on the different sectors as they zigzag their way from south to north, up from Paris to Roubaix, effectively. And it is forecasting a pretty strong wind on, you know, it's not gale force running, but gusts of up to 25 km/h, which, you know, that with any kind of sustained wind as well, make the race fast if it's a tailwind primarily, but there will also then be sectors where you've got a crosswind just because of the nature of the course, and that will have a huge impact also.
Yeah, the courses go, both the men's and women's go roughly south to north, but the they don't really. Particularly once they they're like the men's race is pretty much almost direct for the first 160K, but as soon as they hit the cobbles, it's just big S after S after S, and they kind of go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So yeah, lots of opportunities for those crosswinds to hit. Like the section immediately after Arnberg is a perfect example where you know the Arnberg Forest goes roughly, if I remember correctly, it goes roughly north to south, and then you turn left off of it, and if you've had a tailwind from the start, all of a sudden that's a pretty vicious wind off your left. One of a million different places where that happens.
Yeah, and the wind is forecast very much the same for Sunday. Sunday is forecast to be dry, but as we have already said, if it's been wet for a few days in advance, the roads will not be dry on Sunday.
Well, let's start with the women's race on Saturday. Johnny, who are we looking at for big contenders this year? We've had two editions, and both have been won by the same team. Trek Segafredo undefeated as of yet at Paris-Roubaix, which is part of the reason why we did recon with them yesterday. They're not the heavy favorites coming into this year because their team is somewhat depleted by injuries and illness and maternity leave. And that kind of puts the shoe back on SD Works' foot, I think.
Well, last year, Lotte Kopecker followed up Tour of Flanders with second at Roubaix. She won Tour of Flanders again this year. And then SD Works just seemed to win and keep on winning. So it's at least you've got the balance now between can anyone beat SD Works and can anyone else, apart from Trek Segafredo, win Paris-Roubaix, which brings a dynamic to it. Trek Segafredo, would you look anywhere else?
I actually wonder if one of Lotte Kopecky's teammates is a better bet for Saturday. Lorena Wiebes won Skelde Press on Wednesday pretty convincingly and seems pretty well suited to this particular event. Not an amazing climber. That doesn't really matter at Roubaix. At the moment, the best sprinter in the peloton, though her former DSM teammate Charlotte Kuhl is sort of coming after her on that front. I wonder if she can hang on, whether we end up with a slightly different scenario than we've seen in the last couple of years. We've seen two solo victories in women's Paris-Roubaix out of two editions. First one was Lizzie Deignan going literally in like the third cobble of the entire bicycle race and then going solo into the finish line. I wonder if we might see something a bit different this year. We might see kind of a small to medium-sized group come in because the women's race does take in fewer cobble sectors. I think the teams are getting used to how to race it now. I mean, you know, none of these teams had any direct experience racing Paris-Roubaix as of 3 years ago. So I think that we may end up seeing some dynamics that are slightly different for this year. And if anybody would benefit from that, would probably be Wiebes because she's going to have teammates around. There's no question about that. They have the strongest team in the race. And if it comes down to a bit of a sprint, I think she's the best bet, basically.
I'm going to say that a Backstead is going to win because that gives me three opportunities because you've got Eleanor Backstead for Trek Segafredo, you've got Zoe Backstead for EF Education TIBCO, and then you've got Magnus Backstead who's going to be in the car for Canyon SRAM. So, you know.
Ronan?
I am going to say that Lucinda Brand can go two steps higher on the podium than she did last year. And take the win. I think she has, she was 12th last week in Flanders, which sort of went pretty much unnoticed. Last year was her first year in Roubaix. She didn't do the first edition in 2021. And she told me yesterday that going into the race last year, it was like the first time in a long time that she was the least experienced rider going into a race. And she felt that might have been a bit of a disadvantage before last year, and yet she still finished third. And obviously having a teammate in front helps you coming into a finale like that, and she had Elisa Longo Borghini in front last year. But I just think, you know, she's had a pretty good, if sort of under the radar, spring so far. On the cobbles yesterday she looked phenomenal. I think, you know, obviously Longo Borghini will be probably number one as defending champion within that team. But if Lucinda Brand can sort of play off all eyes been on Borghini, that could open up an opportunity for her.
In the past 2 years, Trek Segafredo have been first and third, both times. So maybe that's why they were so chilled on the recon, is because they're like, well, you know, there's going to be at least two podium spots there.
I did actually ask, I can't remember if it was Enid Tuttenberger or Cohn de Cort, but I asked, you know, we've had two editions of this race. You're undefeated as of yet. Is that why things are so calm here today? And he was like, yeah, well, kind of, you know, we have a new Domani frame, but it's, you know, everything is more or less what we've used previously. We know what to set up. We've done enough recons, we've done enough testing, and this is about kind of sticking to, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it sort of approach.
What about the GOAT? Voss was third at Dwars, had a bit of a late start to the season. She tested positive for COVID literally the morning of Roubaix last year, if you will recall, so didn't get to do it. I mean, you can't really count her out for anything. She's absolutely got the handling skills. There's no question about that. Can she do it tomorrow? Jumbo's been, on the women's side, been pretty quiet this spring so far.
Maybe it's because she has had a later start to the season and we haven't really seen her in action all that much, but... as such, I can't really see it tomorrow or Saturday, but you know, I don't think anybody would be opposed to a Marianne Vos victory.
Well, there's going to be more talk from the women's race on our Wheel Talk podcast, which will come out shortly after the race. I think it'll probably come out Monday, I think. I got to actually ask Abby when they're planning on doing it. But there'll be a lot more chat from the women's race in that. Let's turn over to the men's race on Sunday. Kicks off in Compiègne. Should be dry, at least from the air. We already talked about how it may not actually be dry on the ground. But I think it'll be pretty dry. It's not going to be a horrible, wet, nasty, terrible Paris-Roubaix. It's probably also not going to be the sort of dusty, awful affair that we had for what, 15, almost 20 years prior to the last wet one, was 2 years ago. So, what do we think out of the men's Roubaix? We've got one of the big favorites for you, Johnny.
Instead of the big three, we've got the big two of Wout van Aert and Mathieu van der Poel. And probably this one suits Wout van Aert more than Tour of Flanders. You know, it's more about the endurance of it, about sticking in there, about grinding it out. And I don't know if you're going to draw parallels. If it's those two that are two big favourites, and you're going to draw parallels to what Tadej Pogačar tried to do at Flanders, maybe you see Mathieu van der Poel trying to attack early and draw out Wout van Aert so he can't rely on his superstar team, which includes last year's winner, Dylan van Baarle. You've got Christophe Laporte, and a whole host, really, of guys in that team who can do a job. Mathieu van der Poel has impressive riders too, but not on the same level. Elsewhere, you're looking at Filippo Ganna, maybe. People, that's like, so I reckon that's sort of like the trendy pick this year.
That was my pick.
Ever since somebody picked him for Milan San Remo, that seems
to be a trendy one. I think when you become the trendy pick, I think you're sort of signed off before you've even started, just because, you know.
You have to back it up with an actual result. It can't just be a trendy pick from nowhere. Like, there has to be a result off the back of it.
Mats Pedersen?
Yeah, for sure.
He was stuck chasing potatoes for quite a while at the Tour of Flanders, just sort of stuck in between those groups. And
Chasse patate,
exactly. I have a t-shirt that says that. I genuinely think that he, you know, he showed that he's got some pretty damn good legs at Flanders. He was the best of the rest, so to speak, at the Tour of Flanders. And on paper, Roubaix maybe suits him even better, right? He's not a massive guy, but he's not tiny either. And he's got a pretty good kick on him. And if he gets into that, velodrome with a group of five, you'd want to put some money on him, I think. I think he's a pretty good shot.
Yeah, well, I mean, since he burst onto the scene with third place in Flanders, what year was that? A long time ago, he was Danish national champion. And he went away, was it just after the Paderberg, and rode the final. It was the year Sagan won, I think, and Pedersen rode the finale on his own also. And he's been, you know, classic superstar in the making since then. Then he won a horrendous Harrogate World Championships, with a ride that took real strength also. And so these types of races clearly suit him. The race he did in Flanders last weekend was just, you know, intelligent, gritty, powerful. You know, he anticipated the moves, was one of the first riders to do so. I think he actually launched that sort of move that got the whole anticipation group going, and then attacked that when in a split seconds instinct reaction, attacked that on a downhill, got a gap, rode solo into the Quaremont, just about survived Quaremont within touching distance of Van der Poel. And then ultimately came down to grip sprint, still had the legs to finish it off. And that's exactly the type of form and determination that you need to win a Roubaix. So not outside the realms of possibility in any means. I'm going to go for a different Scandinavian though.
Yeah.
I'm going to go for Alexander Kristoff.
Oh.
Just Stallion. A last hurrah, let's say. Obviously, he's got a multi-year contract to see out, but in terms of monuments, victories, a last hurrah.
Is Heinrich Hassler racing?
No, but Bahrain Victorious have Mohoric, who was fifth last year, and yours two favourites, Fred Wright.
Mm.
Mohoric was one of the sort of animators of the whole race last year. I think it was an untimely puncture that sort of ultimately took him out of the front of the race. So he'll be out for, you know, to sort of right that wrong, as he'll see it.
The one thing I want to see this year is a sprint in the velodrome, because I feel last year was quite anticlimactic, and the only thing you really had to watch inside the velodrome was Brailsford appearing from the sort of the smoke machine he laid out on the ground to announce his arrival to greet Dylan van Baarle. So yeah, I'd like to see a bit more sort of drama, a bit more of a crescendo to the men's Paris-Roubaix this year, and I think a sprint would be blockbuster.
Well, if it does come down to sprint,
yeah,
it could be £10 of sausage in an £8 sack.
I would love that.
We're waiting all spring for, you know, he obviously announced himself at Het Nieuwsblad.
He's gone quiet.
He's gone quiet, and I'm not entirely surprised. I'm not surprised at all, actually, and just that, you know, the level of, you know, the obviously Het Nieuwsblad, huge race, massively important. You know, to win the sprint there, you have to be in flying form, but the level comes up all the way towards Flanders, and I wasn't overly surprised that, you know, when they're actually, you know, there's more of the Flemish Hellingen in the race, and the stakes were even higher. He's still young. I'm not saying he's not going to be at that level. I'm not surprised, because he is still young and he's, you know, such a strong rider, and maybe just takes another year to really perform in those races. But if ever there was a race that potentially suits him, it's really Roubaix, I think. And I wouldn't be surprised if we hear at some point over the weekend that actually this is the race he's been focused on in the spring.
So you're backing either the Stallion or the Sausage Man?
Yes. And come here, if it comes down to a sprint between the two of them, wouldn't that be something?
I don't know if he knows of or approves of this particular...
It is only Kayleigh Fretz who uses that.
Which one, the Stallion or the Sausage Man?
The Sausage.
Okay. Yeah. I don't think he mind it.
I don't think he mind. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, you know, to continue the analogy, Roubaix is good for riders who are a 9 pounds of sausage in an 8 pound sack, and Flanders is better if you're more like 7.5 pounds of sausage in an 8 pound sack. So, I think you're right in that. It's a totally these two races that sit only a week apart, and we stick them together because they're kind of the same type of rider that excels in these two things, but it's not always the case, right? Magnus Backsted was never going to win Tour of Flanders, right? But he wins Paris-Roubaix. Johan van Summeren, same thing. There are riders who can win Roubaix who cannot win Flanders. I think most riders who win Flanders can win Roubaix, but not the other way around, right? We're going to find out with Pogacar at some point, right? But it's just worth noting that, yeah, there's a different set of riders that come into their own for this weekend. I remember talking with Taylor Finney about this one time, and he pointed out that he weighs something like 17 water bottles more than Sepp Van Marck, right? And that kind of puts it in context to how much bigger Taylor Finney was than a rider like Sepp. And then you look at, okay, well, Sepp could do both, and Taylor could only do Roubaix, really. I shouldn't say that. He had some pretty good Flanders as well. But he always saw it as like, I have a legitimately good chance of winning Paris-Roubaix, and I, you know, Flanders is just, it's too hilly for me. So there's this whole set of riders, the big guys, the really big ones that come into play on Sunday.
And, you know, just to put it into perspective as well, Dalee is still only 21 years of age. He's been a pro for a few years now, but a lot of people still might not have, you know, laid eyes on him yet. And I want to, there's a lot of people saying, you know, he might be the next Tom Boonen or whatever. And if we just look at Tom Boonen for a second, Tom Boonen was 1.92 meters and was, you know, give or take around about 80 kilos. Arnaud Dalee is 1.82 meters, so 10 centimeters shorter and the same weight. So that's a different build of rider. Boonen was a Classics Powerhouse was built for the Classics, was built for Flanders and Roubaix. I do think Dilly at the moment is built for Roubaix.
Yeah, agreed. Because he's not, we should say, he's not chubby.
No.
He's just really muscular.
Yeah.
He's like a shortened Christoph or Andre Greipel almost. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely something like those two, yeah.
Yep. Well, we'll find out. I mean, it always feels a bit silly trying to preview Paris-Roubaix in particular because there's so much chaos and there's so... form is important, but luck and a million other things are as important, if not more, for the actual victory, right? And so, yeah, it feels a bit fruitless trying to pick a winner. It's not like Flanders where you can basically say, well, these are the three strongest riders and one of them is probably going to win. We can't really do that for this weekend, and yet we try. I think that's about where we should cut it off soon.
That was one of the things that actually, going back to recon, that was one of the things that jumped out at me. It was, I did not want to interrupt their recon at all. So every time I seen a cobble sector coming, I intentionally dropped back 20, 30 meters before we even hit the cobbles.
Now we just thought you were getting
dropped. That was also happening. But my worst fear was causing a crash, and you're not going to cause a crash if you're at the back of the group. But my second worst fear was one of the riders crashing and me rolling over them. So I dropped back from the group. But what I did notice was how, you know, and obviously the pro riders, so this is not surprising at all, but on the cobbles, on recon, I was struck by how close together they ride, which would inevitably block their view of the road ahead. The holes in the cobbles, the worst of the cobbles, would sort of hit them last second rather than the luxury I had sitting back and being able to pick my line through it, which made it a heck of a lot easier. And I was just thinking, put yourself in the middle of the race when there's not four of your teammates in front of you. There's 100 and odd other riders who want to beat you all around you, and you're going full gas on the cobbles. And that's, you know, we obviously the cobbles are rough, and that's why there's so much carnage in Roubaix. But actually, there's also the fact that the riders just cannot see where they're going, full gas into these things. And, you know, that's why even the best of bike handlers, the best of riders, can have really, really bad luck. The good thing about Roubaix is you can recover from bad luck. And you know,
just keep riding.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all you can really do. Well, we'll cut it off. We're gonna leave you here from our great hosts, the Flandrian Hotel. Thanks to Jamie and the rest of the crew for having us this week. And we'll be back with another episode, I think, after the women's race. It'll either be us or Abby. One of us will pop in and do a breakdown of the women's race after Saturday. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.